Is technology running amok? For instance, privacy breaches have gone from annoyance to challenge to serious problem. This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton speaks with an author and professor who helped build the entire field of crisis management and why we need some. That starts now.
Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening. When tech companies have a public crisis, data breach, security breakdown, manipulation of user data, you often hear similar responses from those companies' executives.
So this was a major breach of trust, and I'm really sorry that this happened.
We've always shared information with other companies, but I think we are doing better and we can continue to do better.
Family telling me to do better.
Okay, that last one was Prezi, but the first two were Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sanders, the top two executives at Facebook. This week, we're going to speak with an academic and author who has a mashup of a book that helps put proven crisis management theories up against a tech industry that too often looks at only the positives of technology, not the unintended negative consequences like the weaponization of fake news or lame responses from execs, as well as hidden data scandals. Basically,
what would a responsible tech company look like?
It's a grave mistake to look at tech companies and not examine their cultures, the mission, the goals, and the ethics of a company that start at the beginning and are perpetuated. Changing culture is hard. But when you survive a corporate crisis with little, if any, repercussion, well, it's reasonable that a company would think it can survive any crisis. Getting to ethical tech companies and crisis management theories. Okay, here we go.
I pronounce it Ian Mitra, usually pronounced the N, and I'm a professor emeritus from USC, and I'm currently a senior research affiliate in the Center for Catastrophic Risk Management at UC Berkeley, my alma mater.
Technology run amok, crisis management in the digital age. We're going to get to the crisis management part because I kind of, when I was skimming the book and preparing for the interview, I did stick with that chapter for sure. But I think let's start at the very beginning. Why write the book?
The reason why I wrote the book is, to put it succinctly, is that technology is more invasive and pervasive than ever before. There's not a single aspect of our lives, our bodies, that it doesn't affect. For example, the latest issue of the Atlantic Monthly has a chilling account of we're ready to place electrodes in our heads to become AI inside our heads and our bodies. It's primarily sponsored by the Defense Department that wants to have the perfect soldier. But it's right on the wave of the commercial market. Mm-hmm. Where it will be sold because we're into upgrading humans and intervening with evolution. Now, the problem with that is, which I get into my book, part of the technological mindset, technologists mainly only look at the positive, hyped aspects of what they do. They don't look at the misuses and the abuses. Facebook is probably the premier example.
Sure.
Of that. Before Facebook was unleashed, there is every good reason to believe that panels composed of kids, teachers, parents would have come up with it being used as a platform for cyberbullying. And the fact that we unleash and dump this stuff out on the world and later try and clean up the worst effects, that's got to stop. And that means that technology companies are going to have to be regulated. It's coming, not just for privacy concerns, but for the abuses and misuses of their technology. And that's primarily why I wrote the book. Now, as I wrote the book and I read a slew of books on technology pro and con, because I have a background in philosophy, suddenly it began to occur to me that there was a mindset driving technologists and their obsession and our obsession with technology. And unless you get to that deeper belief system, we just keep recreating and just recreating our obsession with technology. Now, technology is not going to go away. I have a PhD in engineering. That's not the point. But it's got to be managed better.
Okay.
It's got to be the ethical management of technology. And that's why I wrote the book.
Perfect timing for the book. A lot in your answer right there that I want to unpack. Okay.
Okay.
Let's start with the chilling article in The Atlantic. Then we're going to come back to Facebook because you mentioned the conversion between interference and evolution.
Right.
Through technological implants and things like that. Elon Musk famously has an interface that he's being. Facebook also has a secret project for interface as well. Artificial intelligence seems to be coming to the macro economy a lot faster than any of us really anticipated. Do you feel like you're pushing against a tidal wave?
Yes, in many ways, of course. But the thing is that as I read more contemporary books as they come out, people are coming to the same conclusion that tech companies need to be regulated. For example, if they were media companies,
yes,
then as part of their license to be renewed and granted in the first place, they would have to undergo a crisis plan and have a crisis a deep crisis management part of the company.
That's right.
Not just the chief ethics officer,
right,
but somebody looking at all the potential abuses and misuses.
And that plan has to be available to the public. If you walk up to a television station and ask to look at it, they have to show you a
there
physical
you go.
Copy.
And why should they be exempt if you're held to those standards? Because they have as much impact as anybody in the world.
Ian, let me rely on your philosophy brain for a second. Do you think it's because these technologists and these startup companies and these charismatic CEO/chairmen, which is a corporate structure that we can talk about too, that needs regulated, in my opinion? Do you find that it's because they lack the context it takes to understand what they're unleashing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's part of their education. Look, when I went to engineering school, I loved engineering. But the reason why I left engineering is that the engineering mindset got to me because it put down all the humanities. It put down the things we're talking. And now it's catching up with us big time. I mean, I'll put it in stark terms, maybe not too complimentary. Mark Zuckerberg is obviously bright enough to invent Facebook. He doesn't have the social maturity and breadth of skills to manage a company of that size and that import.
Completely.
And what we're talking about, everybody's dancing, what would a responsible tech company look like? That's what's up for grabs. And no one has the mark. But if we ought to have a contest, we ought to have a competition. People ought to be competing to say, how would we not only what that design would look, but how would we bring it about? And I'm afraid it has to be brought about by government regulation. In fact, I think there needs to be a whole new consumer protection act, not just for privacy. That's the
right
tip of the... Because the
that's what everybody wants to talk about, but you're right. It's not about privacy solely.
The UK is leading the pack in terms of privacy.
Right.
They have very strict... And they're not there with tech. Well, they are there with technology. They have an ombudsman for kids
that
looks at the stuff in the internet and how it impacts kids. And that stuff, which is dangerous, which they deem dangerous,
yes,
how they go, they do everything they can to prevent it. Whether they have sensor power, I don't know. They're leading the pack.
They do keep a very sharp eye on it. Of course, the GDPR writ large in the EU, of course, it helps too. And I would say that regulation, and I totally agree with you on the consumer protection agency, because I mean the consumer protection angle of antitrust, but that's not the argument. That's not because there's no prices put on this. There's no monetary value to it, technically speaking. We just provide them all of our data and then they use it and sell
it.
I'm a full-throated capitalist, and I think that these companies are gobbling up all the competition before we can find out what we're missing out on in the free marketplace.
Well, one of the things that people are talking about for regulating these companies and making them media is that they are monopolistic.
Yes.
And, you know, where, you know, we talk about robber barons, you know, and the FTC and all the rest of that. Well, it's gotten out of hand. It's gotten out of hand even to the point where even tech companies know that regulation is coming. They
oh,
can
yeah.
say, but they resisted it for so long. If they were smart, they could have had a hand in writing the kind of regulation
sure.
that they could have lived with and we could have lived with. But now it's out of control.
And we're back to your answer about having lacking the emotional maturity and context to be able to see that ball coming.
Well, my wife puts it with a metaphor. My wife has a PhD in education, works with children's media to make sure it's appropriate. It's like we created a big sandbox with really shiny toys, but the closer you get to those toys, you realize they're monsters, and where are the adult supervision in the room? And that's what we're talking. In fact, there's a I think an op-ed in today's New York Times talking about adult supervision.
Mm-hmm.
That's been lacking because tech is a young man's game. In fact, even I think Mark Zuckerberg saying women can't do tech. I mean, it gets misogynistic
and all
the rest of that. So.
Yes, I'm with you on that. Let's talk about your book a little bit. Let's go back in here because you've got some solutions in here and you shine some light in the corners of stuff. When you got into your research and you were fleshing out how your book was going to come about, what was one of your foundational premises? And I'm thinking about the definition we talked about briefly.
Well, again, the foundation was I really started with the technological mindset, which was a later chapter.
Yeah.
Again, as I read these slew of books, technology, let me give you the prime element of the belief system. The prime element was technology is the solution to all our problems, including those raised by technology itself. So technology, par excellence, in fact, there's an author whose name, he wrote a book called Homo Deus. And in the book, he said, death is just a technology problem to be solved. Forget about its moral, religious, ethical significance. Right. No, it's just a tech. So everything becomes a techie problem to be solved. If you follow that train of thought, the sooner and better we're replaced by robots and we give all our information to Google, they will make better decisions for us. So humans are devalued as never before. So what I'm saying is technology, for all the benefits that it's brought, and it has, we live longer, better life, it's now one of the greatest threats facing humankind. Artificial intelligence is premised on the premise that all of human behavior and all of human can be reduced to rules. Can't do it.
Right.
Because a lot of what we do, like having a conversation, you can't reduce it to a rule. A lot of it's unconscious. We don't know the full contents of our mind. But that's the other part of the techie mindset, one of the biggest parts that's disturbing, is they tend to only see the positive and hype the positive aspects of their creations and don't pay any attention at all to the potential negative side effects and anything. That's got to change. So what I propose in the book is I lay out the technological mindset, then I lay out a countervailing humanistic mindset to say, we're going to have technology. That's not the point. But the point is, what is the better way of coping and managing technology? And that's the discussion we ought to be having. And unfortunately, I don't see it. You know, even I rant and rail against technology, but it needs to move to the next level, the kind of conversation to say, suppose we were to design a tech responsibly, a socially responsibly tech, and a socially responsibly tech industry. That, in fact, may be my next book.
Yes.
Because that's the thing that we need.
I encourage you to read a friend of the show, Vivek Wadhwa, who is a professor emeritus like you, except at Carnegie Mellon and at Stanford. He's been on the show a couple times. He's on the same thread as you are right here. We're speaking with Dr. Ian Mitroff, author of a wonderful new book, Technology Run Amok, Crisis Management in the Digital Age. Okay, in that chair not too long ago, I had the co-founder of Wired Magazine.
Okay.
And he told me about artificial intelligence. He wants it to come forward because it will take care of the mundane functionality of human life and modern life, and allow humans to do what they do best, which is create, make mistakes and things like that. Is that out of bounds for you?
Well, no, I mean, but see, that's, again, part of the techie mindset. You just look at the positive part and say, yeah, I understand that, like, get rid of a lot of the mundane. But what else is it going to encroach on?
Yeah.
You mean it's just going to be restricted to the mundane? Look, when robots were first invented, they couldn't sort like fine pieces of paper. They were clunky. Now they can do more refined tasks. Mm-hmm. I understand. Here's the point about, we don't know all the stuff that is embedded in the fancy algorithms. Because we can create this stuff, but to think that we know all the consequences, that's mass delusion. We got enough delusion going on in the political scene. That's a whole other conversation.
Right.
It's so tempting just to see the positive unrestrained.
Right.
And not want to look, again, like Facebook. Look, one of the things about Facebook that we said we'd get back to is that a mounting body of data evidence shows the more kids use Facebook, the lonelier and more isolated and more depressed they feel. One of the reasons why for a kid to get on Facebook, they have to have an idealized portrait of themselves, which is up against all the other super idealized portraits. And talk about, you know, one of the ill effects of Facebook. Of course, there's going to be something like Facebook. But can you imagine what? One of the things that I understand that Facebook has done, one of the most reprehensible, is that they've used facial recognition to sear on kids with low self-esteem and then sell that data to third parties who will then prey upon them. That's not what we're supposed to. Is that the way we talk about connecting with kids? Sherry Turkle, who's a clinical psychologist at MIT, written a marvelous book called Alone Together. Facebook and social media have all but destroyed the art of conversation with young kids. It's easier to text than to Twitter. But I'll give you another one, the unanticipated consequences of technology. MIT engineers have developed gold leaf tattoos, which can be placed right on your skin, that will allow us to communicate seamlessly with all our devices. Okay, kids already sleep with their cell phones under their ear at night unless they miss it. Now their skins are going to be buzzing all night long. That's what I mean, that we can't continue to dump this stuff out in the world and later clean up the ill effects. That is the primary message in my book. We have to look a better job at looking at what we don't want to look at.
That's tough.
Well, let me give you an example of I mean, how it can be done.
It's hard to be self-critical, especially when all the bells and whistles. I mean, these things are designed to make us happy. They're basically casinos in our pockets.
Well, they're addictive. I mean, about a couple of months ago, there was a guy on 60 Minutes, a guy who finally left Google because he was tired of designing all the apps that were addictive. And he tried, you know, sound the whistle and everything. But let me give you an example how it can be done. It's very unusual. It's problematic. Most companies would never do it. Years ago, I founded the first academic research center in the world for crisis management. And we had corporate sponsors not only gave us money to do our research, but they gave us access. So one time I went out on the road, and I went to this major pharmaceutical company. And so I walk into this guy who's agreed to talk to me, and I say, what are you guys doing about product tampering? You know, the main thing that pharmaceutical companies work at. So without missing a beat, he turned to me and he said, we have an internal assassin team. I said, what? He said, yeah, one day we held up one of our pills, painkillers. We looked at the cap as the front door of the house, the walls of the wall. How could the burglar get in, do the most damage, and remain undetected? We soon learned very quickly no such thing as tamper-proof bottles. But we came up with tamper evidence. So if something is bridged, the consumer would know. I have since tried that. Can you imagine if more companies adopted? Because somebody is out there plotting right away how to do you in.
Yeah.
So either you do it or they're going to do it to you.
Right.
You have no choice. Is it unpleasant? Of course it's unpleasant. Because then you've got to look at the potential demise of your baby. Who wants to do that? Well, that's my job. And people who do crisis management.
Right.
Because better we do it and protect ourselves than somebody like Facebook uses as a platform for fake news, for interference with
still
our...
Still is, yeah.
It still is. It's still the data breach of Cambridge Analytica. When will they get it? Because they're playing catch-up ball. You know, it's
Exactly. That was going to be my follow because, you know, Facebook says 30 million accounts. That's Facebook speak for probably 100 million.
Yeah, right.
Let's talk about specific companies. I don't mind. Look, Facebook has not, in my opinion, addressed what it said it was going to address at the beginning of this year. It has never really addressed it. It's always, you know, it's always, we need to do better, and we're sorry.
Yeah,
right?
We're sorry.
Yeah.
And Sheryl Sandberg said, and we missed the big picture.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the big picture includes crisis management from the very beginning. And a look at your company again, how things will be abused and misused.
And there's a corporate efficacy argument to be made here as well. If the CEO is legally bound to provide shareholder value, this is a way to do it.
I'll give you another piece of evidence that when I ran my Center for Crisis Management, I had some very bright students who did PhD dissertations with me. We sent out a survey to the Fortune 1000 company a couple of months before 9/11. We didn't know 9/11 was going to happen. And what we found was terrorism was zilch. Nobody was doing. Then 9/11 happened and said, hey, we got to send out the same survey. Now terrorism goes to the top of the list. 2 years later, it's down where it was before 9/11. But here's what we found out doing the survey. Those companies which were proactive and practiced good crisis were significantly more profitable than those companies. They experienced fewer crises. They had crises. Mm-hmm. They recovered faster, fewer lawsuits, fewer injuries, death. So crisis management is not only the right ethical thing, it's good for business. So the point is, if it is built in at the very beginning, if a venture capitalist insists that you got to do this, you're going to protect yourself, you got to protect your customers and all the rest, it's going to pay off. Sure, it's going to be money up front, but the money you invest in crisis management is far less. Look at Facebook's stock. When it had a crisis, its stock took a big tumble, which affected all of us on the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not that it could have avoided everything, but I would guarantee you, again, from our data and the data of other, it's good business. It's not only the right ethical, but it's good for business.
I'll mention a different social networking company that I think has done at least a little bit more than Facebook, and that's Twitter.
Yes.
Okay. Twitter decided to open the kimono a little bit when it comes to its fake news data and its collection of said data, allowing researchers like yourself and your team to look at it. Why isn't Facebook doing the same thing?
Well, you know, what we're talking about is the culture of a company. That's the point. The thing that runs an organization, you're in an organization, which is the leadership, the history of it, how you can dress, how you can speak, what issues you can raise, what things you don't raise, which things are verboten, all the rest of that.
Right.
So from day one, the culture, whether it's the internal assassin team, and says, Are we going to take a hard look at the things that we don't want to? And I want to hear bad news. I did recently a crisis audit for a company that does a lot of medical work. I'm not going to identify the company because it's critical. And when I went around, I go around on day 20 interviews when I do a crisis audit of an organization. I not only interview the top managers, I interview the worker bees. Mm-hmm. And the thing that came up again and again, a malicious employee. Suppose somebody really knows our code that analyzes medical samples and interfered with the samples themselves and the computer code. They could do all kinds of havoc. Well, do we want to know that or not? On the one hand, we have a very good culture. We don't want to destroy the culture by becoming Orwellian. But we got to face this problem. We got to come up with good ways to attack it. Now, I can't do that. I can spur the creativity. But people have a lot of creativity, whether it's focused on the right things or the wrong. So Facebook's creativity was focused on growing the base, growing the business, and selling your data. Well, that's the culture. And once that culture is in place with the current leadership, it's very, very difficult. I've written an op-ed in the San Francisco Chronicle saying Zuckerberg ought to go. Who would replace him? I don't know. It's almost like I wish there were an ethical Facebook. And maybe you ought to pay for it instead of that would be the choice. Mm-hmm. So you secure your privacy.
So you've touched on something there, too. I have a friend of the show as well, Jason Calacanis, who is a startup and angel investor, got rich doing such. He said the same thing. He's actually tweeted, if you're an entrepreneur and you can come up with an ethical version of Facebook, I will fund you to get going.
There you go.
I mean, and if that's a market opportunity by somebody who's quite successful in startups and angels, it seems to me that your book should not just be a conversation starter. There should be some real tailwind to it.
Well, that's the kind of person I'd like to talk with and meet. I'll tell you the other thing. If I were younger and I wanted to do Social Impacts, Inc., a company that would look at the impacts of your technology, pro and con, good and bad, and help to advise you how to get around the bad, that would be the business that I would help to found. I think somebody ought to found. And I think there is a market for that. And that would help to say, what would an ethical, socially responsible Facebook look like and Twitter and YouTube and all the rest of them? I'm proud, and I'll pat myself to say I'm one of the founders of the field of crisis management. My first job was at the University of Pittsburgh. I had an incredible consulting assignment with McNeil Pharmaceuticals, makers of Tylenol. And this was before the Tylenol poison.
The scare,
they were an ethical company because as part of J&J, customer safety and well-being comes before profit. So when the Tylenol poisoning occurred, there was no hesitation of doing a nationwide recall.
Right.
Even though it cost them money because they had to. That's an ethical company.
Right.
Not perfect.
They didn't just survive that crisis. They actually thrived afterwards.
Right.
And the trust that comes with something like that. I mean, that's a market opportunity.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Now, they didn't necessarily encumber. They didn't get full crisis management because there's also danger. If you do well in one crisis, a la Facebook, you survive.
Yeah.
You think you can survive everything coming down. So, it's Peter Drucker, who's one of the eminent business consultants of all time, saying nothing fails like success.
Let's talk about Chapter 10.
Okay.
Contesting the technological mindset. We've spent a lot of time talking about it, and you've teed it up. I think I have a good working definition of it right now. But I do have to say I felt a little helpless when I was listening to it because it just seems like where do I push back on something this big? I mean, how would you suggest – I understand macro policy decisions at a congressional level, and we all should vote those things in. But let's say, personally, for me as an individual, how would you suggest that I approach
it? Well, let me suggest somebody that you need to have on your show, and I'd like to meet my publicist. Maybe we can... Ro Khanna.
I've had Ro on.
He has come up with, I think, a 10-step program.
Yes, yes.
For controlling privacy.
So you're cool with that one?
Yes, I am. Oh, very. I agree with what... Now he needs to be expanded out to the broader field of technology.
Okay.
So what we need to do, yes, it's messy, but I haven't given up in government. What else do we have? I'm not anti-government like a lot of people running around think we'd be better off with no government. Get real for crime. Yeah. These institutions have taken centuries to build up, and they can be disabled. So we need to get people like that and to say,
okay,
if you get democratic control of Congress, you get a more socially responsible. What can we do to get a new federal agency? Yes, it's going to take time. But that's our eyes on the prize.
Okay.
That's what, and yes, I know it's not here and all, but I believe I'm beginning to see, not just myself, but people like myself, who are beginning to talk for regulations and some kind of a federal agency. I think that's going to happen.
Well, we got the Consumer Protection Board out of the seismic event, which was the Great Recession, right?
That's right.
But how many seismic events have we already gone through with tech? I mean, cause
you know,
this.
I don't know. You know, it's like, I'll give you another one that it's another big bite, which I do talk about in the book, is that how many more innocent kids need to be killed before we have more sensible gun regulation? No, we're not going to take away all the guns. And
no.
You know, one of the sad things that I quote, we're 4% of the world's population with 45% of the world's gun. Mm-hmm. Anybody who thinks that a society can manage all that, the one variable above all that predicts mass shootings in a society is the sheer number of guns in a society. So I don't know. You know, we are facing, here's the point, a number of social problems that are all coming due at the same time.
Yes, yes.
That's it. And we need to have, you know, politicians, a government that wakes up and recognizes and gets on the ball.
And books.
And
research. I'm sorry, but this is a formidable book because you're bringing a philosophy, a humanities background, as well as an engineering, and your consulting and your academic research as well. So I can't wait to share some other emails with you of other guests I've had.
I would love.
I got to have a forum with you guys. I mean, it's going to be great.
That I would love. Let me just say one thing about the what changed me forever. I mean, I have a BS in engineering physics from Cal, a master's in structural. When I got a PhD, I switched to industrial engineering so I could study people in an organization. But the thing that changed me and allowed me to do this book, I took a 3.5-year minor in the philosophy of science, which a college of engineering didn't understand. That's what made me into a social scientist. And the man who taught me philosophy was a philosopher. He was in the Berkeley Business School. So I went to a business school. I didn't want to go into an engineering school because this stuff was unpalatable. And that was one of the best things because then I'm one of the founders of the field of crisis management. Mm-hmm. I have the luck of being one of the founders of a new field, creating a field from scratch, which is incredible. Like
right.
This book here, is one of the most, I regard it one of the most important things I've ever done. This is my 37th book.
I had no idea your bibliography was that long.
I have a lot of energy. But this is one of the most important things I've ever done because how important technology, how it envelops, encompasses our life.
I got caught up in our conversation. I kind of missed a couple of points. Let's put some legs under the stool again. What did you want to talk about?
Well, the thing is, the two things about crisis management that most people don't understand, that when I started my Center for Crisis Management at USC, I had doctoral students working for me, and they went out into the field and talked with the managers, and they said, well, we'd like to do crisis management, but here's what our top management tells us. And we got all these rationalizations.
Mm-hmm.
And because I knew my Sigmund Freud, one of the most important parts of Freud, our defense mechanism. And it turned out for every one of the individual defense mechanisms pertained to people, there was a counterpart that pertained to, for example, denial. Mm-hmm. We're so good, problems don't happen to us. We're so big and powerful, nothing bad. The more defense mechanism that an organization used, the more crisis-prone it was. Yeah, a crisis that only causes a financial mess and debts in lawsuits and all the rest of that. But one of the least appreciated things that a crisis does, it invalidates in one fell swoop all the assumptions you've been making why you won't get into a crisis. And the premier example of that is... Now I'm going to block it at the, what was the federal building in Oklahoma City that was blown up by Timothy McVeigh.
Yes.
And prior to that, there were three major assumptions. One, terrorism only happens in Europe, not here. Secondly, an American won't act as a terrorist and kill. And third, innocent men, women, and worst of all, children won't be killed to make a political point. So the whole belief system crashed. And that's why a crisis is really an existential crisis. It's a crisis of men. Because if your whole belief system crashes, what do you have left to stand on? And that's what's happening to the tech companies. They've created crises of their own making. And now they're suffering the consequence. And if they had any brains, for all the brains they presume, they would get out in front and really do a good crisis number on themselves.
That's a good place to end it, I think, because that's a summary judgment. Again, thank you so much for coming into the studio. Much appreciated.
Thank you for having me.
That was Professor Ian Mitroff. He's author of Technology Run Amok, Crisis Management in the Digital Age. Ian Mitroff is one of the principal founders of the modern field of crisis management. He is also trained in philosophy, engineering, and he teaches at USC and Cal Berkeley. We are also at facebook.com/techonomicsradio, and I'm on Twitter at KGO Jason. For executive producer Jack Swanson, I'm the host and the writer Jason Middleton. Thanks again for listening, and have great weeks, everybody.